from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Nina Kim. Coming up on Forum, for decades, David Talbot has been a fixture of Bay Area journalism. He was the founder of Salon.com, editor of the San Francisco Examiner, and author of the best-selling book Season of the Witch, which chronicled the history of San Francisco's counterculture. Talbot's new memoir is called Between Heaven and Hell. In it, he recalls the stroke that he had in 2017 and how it not only changed his life, but also saved it. He says he's more introspective than ever, filled with what he calls an ineffable light and joy. David Talbot joins us to talk about his experience with illness and how it transformed him. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Journalist and Salon.com founder David Talbot has spent his career writing about others, covering topics such as the Kennedy years and the history of San Francisco counterculture. Now, after suffering a massive stroke in November of 2017, Talbot is writing about himself. In his new book, Between Heaven and Hell, The Story of My Stroke, he recounts the stroke's lasting physical effects, how it changed his perspective and gave him a front row seat to the complexity that define America's healthcare system. Welcome to Forum, David Talbot.
Hi, Mina. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for being here. And can you start by telling us what happened that November night at the restaurant in 2017?
Yeah, I was celebrating. I thought I was celebrating yet another victory among many victories and many defeats in my struggle to translate my books, my history books, to the screen in Hollywood. And I was having dinner with friends at a neighborhood French bistro, and I stood up, and suddenly it was as if the lights dimmed in my head. And I thought, well, maybe I just had one glass of Chablis too many during dinner. But my friends noticed something odd. I made the mistake of driving home that night, and actually for the next 24 hours, the stroke was rather clandestine, as I write. Nothing overt, no major symptoms. But about 24 hours later, this so-called stuttering stroke, which took about 48 hours to unfold in its entirety, had left me paralyzed on one side, seeing double, and suffering a major stroke.
There's a moment that you describe when you woke up in the ICU at Davies, and you say you felt mangled, but oddly ecstatic, even celestial. What did you mean by this?
Well, it's funny. I'm not a religious person or particularly spiritual. I'm a journalist, and I've, just the facts, ma'am, kind of life, very secular, even though I did teach Sunday school as a boy years ago in Los Angeles. But I felt amazingly graced to still be alive and relatively intact. As I say, I was kind of a mess. I couldn't get out of bed by myself. I couldn't see straight. I couldn't even swallow. Nurses had to nervously watch me take ice chips because it could cause me to choke or aspirate any kind of liquid or solid. So it took 5 weeks in the hospital at Davies, and I have to give a shout-out to the stroke ward at Davies Hospital here in San Francisco. It's an amazing crew of dedicated people from all around the world. It's a complete rebuff to Donald Trump's, white nationalism. These are nurses, therapists, doctors from every corner of the globe, and they're all dedicated to their work, and they worked with me as if they believed that I could recover. At a time when I didn't think I could recover, frankly. So they restored my faith not only in myself but in humanity. They worked so well together, and as I say, they were so energetic and so full of optimism that it gave me – it was infectious. It gave me that spirit too. I think I was just overjoyed to be alive. To tell you the truth, Mina, I was feeling stuck in late midlife. I was 66 when I had my stroke. I felt I'd done just about everything I wanted to do professionally. I started Salon.com, written these books that kind of challenge conventional history of America. and of San Francisco. And yet the one thing I wanted to do most in a way at that point in my life was, as I say, make movies or TV shows out of my books to reach a wider audience. But it's endlessly frustrating for an author to be in L.A. You don't have any control or power, unlike my son, Joe Talbot, who's a director. As a lowly book author, you're really at the bottom of the totem pole. So I felt stuck, burdened, stressed out. I was a walking candidate for a stroke.
Yes, you talk about how you felt almost like Hollywood broke you, that it played a big role in some of this sense of feeling stuck. And so can you describe what that experience was?
Well, I was commuting down to L.A., you know, meeting with A-list directors, David O. Russell, others, who would option my book. Major global media companies had whole teams of writers from Mad Men and from top series. I was meeting at one point with the head of the motion picture industry, who was involved as a producer. I mean, these were top level people in Hollywood. And all of them were very optimistic in the beginning. But I began to feel like Charlie Brown and Lucy, you know, each year falling for the same football trick and not being able to hit the ball while Lucy snatches away at the last minute. You know, you, as an author, you're filled, your experiences often just hit one roadblock after the next. And that's what happened with me in Hollywood. And there was one day I was sitting in a meeting and there was a huge group of people, writers, directors, agents. I don't understand why the room was so full, but it was. And it was my job to try and interpret my book, The Devil's Chessboard, which is an epic history of what basically went wrong with America in the 20th century, focusing on the CIA and the rule of Alan Dulles. And I felt my head just getting expanding and also kind of throbbing at the same time. And I excused myself from the meeting and rushed down the hallway and splashed water in my face. My heart was beating. I knew my blood pressure, which was quite high at the time, was probably also spiking. I knew that moment I was probably going to have a heart attack or a stroke. But I went back to the meeting, and I think I sealed my doom by doing that because I had a stroke soon after that, about a week or two later.
You know, it's interesting as you describe this experience of meeting with these Hollywood bigwigs, your, you know, dinner at the restaurant. I can get a picture of, you know, the David Talbot life pre-stroke, you know, just kind of this go, 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 very high stakes. You've talked about how you feel like you're a different person now. Can you describe how different your life is now than the one that you just described?
Yes. Well, the obvious way, I mean, is I feel physically different. I feel as if my head is in a bell jar, as I write in my book. I feel encased. I don't feel – it's a feeling you have sometimes early in the morning before you have your first cup of coffee or you take a shower. You're a little numb. That feeling is kind of persistent and chronic. It's a post-stroke syndrome. So I feel like I walk through life in somewhat of a daze. And I hope I sound very articulate and present.
Very much.
But to tell you the truth, I often feel like I'm living life unremote. And so it was very important for me to begin to write again because that was my profession. And this book began as on social media, and I began to write when I couldn't even write. My hand was more like a claw as I write. I had to correct every other word. I couldn't touch type anymore. That was gone. And yet I was touching a nerve with other people who've suffered their own traumas, their own health disasters, and were writing back to me beautiful, in some cases, beautiful mini essays about their own lives. And that encouraged me to keep communicating because I felt I was touching enough people. And I feel with this book, it's given me a chance that no other book I've written has. I'm out there speaking at book events all over the Bay Area. And the people line up to get assigned copies of my book. They all have their incredible stories. A young mother the other day, a woman no older than late 30s, had a young daughter at home. And she has a very rare condition, has a series of mini strokes, each of which really debilitate her. And yet she goes on. So I say that my philosophy of life, Mina, since my stroke has become one of stoic exuberance. I choose not to live my life in bitterness or regret. I choose to go on. I know that I'm debilitated in many ways and will be for the rest of my life, and yet I'm exuberant to be alive.
Yes. In the sense, I know I was quite struck when you talk about, you know, just what it's like to try to cross a busy street in San Francisco. The other thing, though, that I loved was this joy that you seem to take in sort of the everyday things, the ordinary everyday chores, activities, errands. What is that experience for you?
Well, that was kind of a modest kind of surprise in my life that I enjoy doing smaller things, as you say now. You know, before my life was filled with deadlines. When I was at Salon, we were constantly struggling back in the dot-com era to not only break through journalistically by reporting stories that no one else was, like during the Clinton impeachment crisis when we made our name, but also to stay alive financially. We were always on the brink of bankruptcy at Salon. So it was from one crisis to the next, one deadline to the next. That was my whole life. And I felt I never had patience for even my own family often. I was like timing them if they came to talk to me about something. It was – I must have been – well, I know I was kind of obnoxious to live with. My wife has shared that with me. But now I think, you know, being a patient for weeks and months teaches you a patience. It has to. You know, Ram Dass, the great spiritual guide from my generation who died recently, he had a stroke at age 66, and he survived for many years after that. And he said in his book, you know, don't try to go back to who you are because that is foolish, and you never will become be again who you are. You have to adapt to the new you. So the new me is slower, more patient. I listen. I think more carefully to people. I enjoy each day of my life in a way I didn't before because I was living life only in the future as a journalist and historian and as a media entrepreneur. Now each day of my life feels like the last day of my life because I think it might be.
Do you ever grieve for the old you?
That's a good question. You know, I've never been asked that. There's you know, kind of pedestrian things, or not pedestrian, automotive things I regret. Like, I can't drive anymore. I can't hop in the car and get out of the city. The city does feel loud and chaotic to me more than ever, for obvious reasons, because it is more loud and chaotic, more congestion, more construction everywhere. So that tends to feel oppressive to me sometimes. And my escape used to be hopping in the car and going to Point Reyes, because the kind of wilderness in West Marin is my sanctuary. And I can't do that as easily now. You know, I feel like I said I related to my dog, Brando, because he was so dependent on others. You know, for, hey, will you take me to the park now? Hey, can I go for a ride in the car? Hey, I'm getting hungry here. So I was home with Brando a lot when I was recovering, and he was another caretaker for me. And, you know, I had to learn Brando's patience, too, that you have to depend on the kindness of others. Brando, sadly, after spending 2 years helping me recover, died very suddenly the day after Christmas. I'm still mourning his loss.
I'm sorry. Yes, I think you've described that loss as far more traumatic than you expected it to be.
Yeah, I never had a dog as an adult before. I did as a kid, but Brando lived to be 10, and I say, you know, he became very intertwined emotionally with my family, not just me, but my wife and my two sons. He was the most empathetic creature you can imagine. You know, when we'd be watching a ball game and, you know, my older son Joe gets particularly agitated during the intense games and be screaming at the TV, Brando would come over and lay a heavy paw on your knee and not take it off until you calm down. And when I came home from the hospital, he jumped up on the bed where I was and he put his paws around my shoulders, on both shoulders, looking. And he looked directly into my eyes as if to say, you know, I can't believe you're home. I'm going to, you know, here I am. And he lay in my bed and stayed there for the next several weeks as I recovered. And he followed me as I relearned to walk on a walker back and forth all day long in my house. He followed every step of the way to make sure I wouldn't fall. He was an amazingly, you know, I don't know how to describe it, a spirit animal or something. When he was dying at the vets the other day, I made sure as he was put down that I looked into his eyes because I wanted him to see what love he'd given me, the way he gave it back to me when I was recovering.
Mm. We're talking to author and journalist David Talbot about his latest book, Between Heaven and Hell, The Story of My Stroke. And David Talbot, as we talk about your family members and we talk about Joe, I wonder what impact his success had on you. I had the great pleasure of interviewing him on Forum for the Last Black Man in San Francisco. And, you know, you were going through so much as he was making this, and to see the success of it now, I wonder, you know, how that affects your life now.
Well, by the way, as I was recovering, I did listen to the interview, and I thought that was a particularly, you know, revealing and warm interview. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
And I think Joe and Jimmy Fails, who's the star of the film, and they're a great creative team, I think it was important for them coming home after being on tour and having an interview like that on KQED with you. I can't tell you how grateful I am that I lived. In part because of Joe's film. You know, he came into the hospital and I thought I was dying the first night. I was surrounded by my wife Camille, my brother Steve, his family, Joe and Nat, my two sons. And I thought I was dying, and I was saying goodbye to people in kind of my very strangled voice. I could barely speak then. And I felt amazingly kind of, serene to be saying goodbye. I thought I could go because I'd done everything I needed to do. But Camille and Joe, my wife Camille and my son Joe, were insistent. I remember their looks to this very day. They looked at me, locked eyes with me, and said, "No, you're not dying." Because I knew then they needed me. They needed me to stick around, not just for myself, but for them. And I needed to be less selfish. And I needed to be here to watch Joe make his first movie. And I can't tell you how ecstatic I was at Sundance last year when Joe's film premiered there and Joe won the Best Director Award. And all the crew, the kids who he'd grown up with, many he'd cast in the movie, and Jimmy, his childhood friend he'd made the movie with, who starred in the film. It was as if I had lived for that moment. And then to be able to share in Joe's joy and success and Jimmy's, who's like another son to me all year long, is a joy beyond description. So that's why I feel that I'm in some ways still on earth, not for me, but for others.
Well, I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation. We're talking with David Talbot. His latest book is Between Heaven and Hell, The Story of My Stroke. And maybe you or someone you know has had a stroke or a similar experience. What was that experience like for you? Or just what are your questions for David Talbot? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter, on Facebook, or at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. You know, as I hear you talk about writing about your experiences and how healing that was, beginning on Facebook and then eventually this memoir, I was amused that you originally kind of had sort of an opinion of memoirs, that they were just not something you particularly respected. And so how has this process changed your view of memoirs generally?
Another good question. You're right. I did tend to disdain memoirs in the past. I read some and enjoyed some. I tend to like memoirs by musicians, by great musicians I've admired, like Bob Dylan wrote a very quirky memoir called Chronicles that I enjoyed, or Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones, his memoir. I think you have to accomplish something, and you have to have a unique way of telling your story to take on the task of doing that. Otherwise, it's kind of shallow and narcissistic to me, that process. And I don't think enough people have actually earned the right to write a memoir. And I always felt that way about myself. And so, in a way, this is more than a memoir. It's a forced self-reflection. And it's a forced kind of task of looking inside myself. I've been looking outside for so long at the country, what went wrong with America, how San Francisco survived the turbulence of the 60s and 70s and emerged a great city with San Francisco values in my book, Season of the Witch. But I never really, as a writer, had looked inside myself. I was forced to do that as part of my rehabilitation, as you say, on Facebook, writing these messages. And seeing the kind of impact I was having on others made me feel like I was a public intellectual in a different way than I'd been with my history books. Hmm. I was playing a strange kind of healing role for people. You know, I don't think we think enough in our society, in America, in the West in general, about life and death. You know, we're all born with a termination date. So we all have to ask ourselves, if we're reflective at all, have I done enough with my life? What do I want to do in whatever time remains on earth for me? I was given such a brutal wake-up call when I had my stroke. I had to face those deep questions in a way I never had before in my life. And I think we all should do that. You know, George Harrison, the Beatle, who I look to as a great role model in some ways or inspiration, because he said he thought about death or prepared for his death every day of his adult life. And, you know, some way we need to integrate the shadow with the light. And I think America is so busy doing and spending and you know, trying to enjoy or avoid pain and boredom that we don't spend enough time understanding that we're only on Earth for a finite time and we have to make the most of it.
Well, this listener writes, terrifying story. There seems to be a very large variation of experience for different kinds of strokes. Glad to see Talbot is back with us. I mean, one thing uniquely, David Talbot, is that you survived your stroke and you are also able to write so beautifully about the experience and share this with others. I mean, I will be honest, my father suffered a stroke when he was 8 years old and he did not live. And so this is a bit of a window for me into what his experience was.
Well, no, believe me. I feel fortunate that I was not devastated even more and that I am, as I say, relatively intact and I can still use the part of my brain that still functions and write and you know, enjoy life. I know that many others are more debilitated than I am. My mother died from a series of strokes, and each stroke took more from her. Even the first stroke, she returned not the same person, and she was only 56 or 7 when she had her first stroke. She died at age 60. So, you know, but my mother was another inspiration. I have to say she's been coming back to me a lot. You know, she worked for years after we all went off to college. She raised her kids at the kidney dialysis unit at Children's Hospital in Los Angeles for some 15 years. And wow. At that point, a kidney disease was a death sentence. Those kids would live for a few months or even years, but they never reached adulthood. And my mother was the heart and soul of that unit. And the kids she would hold the kids' hands and sing to them show tunes when they were wheeled into surgery. And she consoled the inconsolable parents. So my mother also was an inspiration to me. No matter what you're suffering, you have to choose your attitude in life, like Viktor Frankl wrote in his book about concentration camps, Man's Search for Meaning. That's the only power we have as humans. What attitude do we want to adopt as we live?
Yes. Well, we'll have more with David Talbot after the break. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, sitting in for Michael Krasny. For decades, David Talbot has been a fixture of Bay Area journalism. He was the founder of Salon.com, an editor of the San Francisco Examiner, and author of the best-selling book Season of the Witch. Now Talbot has a new memoir. It's called Between Heaven and Hell, and he recalls the stroke that he had in 2017 and how it changed him. As we were going into the break, we were listening to a song that David Talbot had put in a playlist that he created, and it's a playlist called Songs for Strokies, and the song itself is called My Mind. It's called Mind by Teenage Fan Club. And before I go to calls, which if you'd like to join us, listeners, that number 866-733-6786, again, 866-733-6786. Also get in touch on Twitter, Facebook, or email us. David Talbot, I do want to ask you about the inspiration for creating this playlist.
Yeah, well, thank you for playing that song. I played that song a lot as I was kind of relearning how to dance. And even now, I still dance for therapy, for fun. But I dance close to a couch because I do tend to tip over now and then, and I want to, you know, fall softly. Teenage Fan Club was, just popped into my playlist somehow. I was scouting around for fun music. And it's a great Scottish, I think, bar band. Started out back in the 90s, maybe, or 80s. And that song captured, I think, my mood in a way. It talks about how he feels like he's floating on water. And that's, my daily kind of experience often. Each song that I put on the playlist in my book reflects a different part of me at the time I was recovering, either kind of sometimes anger, because there is anger recovering from a stroke. I'm Still Alive, the Pearl Jam song, which is kind of shout, where he shouts out the chorus, is full of kind of a fury. If you read the lyrics, you understand why. But in my, I was kind of really exuberant, like I say, and also kind of defiant, I think is the right word, defiant that I was still alive. You know, one doctor, I have to say, at the hospital where I was recovering was not very optimistic. He came in, he was a brain surgeon, very arrogant, very brusque, and he sized me up right away by asking me a few routine questions. And then he began to tell me, look, you're going to be screwed up the rest of your life, basically. He had me in tears, actually, by the end. And he had one odd thing. He pointed to his he asked me what city I lived in, who was president, the routine questions to make sure someone hasn't entirely lost their mind, all of which I answered easily. And then he pointed to his really strange suit. He was wearing kind of a gangster-like suit with big wide lapels. And he pointed to his suit, and he wanted me to tell him that it was a lapel. And I said, he said, what's this? And I said, a cheap suit, because I was so angry at the guy. And he said, what? And I said, oh, a lapel. But later, Rebecca Riley, who is my speech therapist at Davies, a wonderful woman, I hope she's listening, she came in and I was crying and I explained why. And she said, did he point to his lapel? And I said, yeah, she knew his drill. So, everyone else at the hospital was so supportive, so warm, so helpful to me. I had nurses who came in who laid gemstones on me to give me a sort of a healing warmth, along with the traditional medicines. They were using a lot of alternative medicine because at that point, I was willing to try anything, things I'd never done before, acupuncture, meditation, gemstones. And, thank God I was in a hospital in San Francisco where they do integrate alternative medicine with traditional medicine.
Well, I should correct myself and say that the title of the song was It's All in My Mind by Teenage Fan Club. And I hope we will also get a chance to hear some more from that later in the hour. But in the meantime, I would like to get our listeners into the conversation. And I'll start with Leslie in San Francisco. Leslie, join us. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. Hi. Well, I just wanted to say I read David's book and I enjoyed it. And this morning, I'm connecting so deeply to his comments about, not only family members who I've been dealing with, as he's dealt with, you really need them to pull through for you, and they're dealing with such extreme illnesses, and that connected with me, and especially his spirit animal comments, because I think we're neighbors in the park, and I will tell you that my dog, Ida, is absolutely my spirit animal. She has absolutely gotten me through all those kinds of things he's described so beautifully this morning. And I just wanted to say thank you for that. And that I'm just sort of crying about it.
Well, Leslie, thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. I cry every day about Brando because we probably share the same park where he walks. Every day I walk by the park, it's hard on me. Loss is something we all have to, accommodate as we get older, particularly, and we lose more friends and family members. And I say what keeps me going is my circle of love. And it's not a village, I say, because villages tend to be strange and weird and full of gossip, I think. So I use the term circle of love. And they were my family members, but also my friends, my dear friends, who brought, you know, casseroles and cookies over to my house, who called up my wife, Camille, and asked if she could, if they could do anything for her, who, you know, we were broke because I'm a freelance writer, and Camille had to stop working on her own great book. She's writing a literary biography of the great novelist Robert Louis Stevenson and his kind of kick-ass American pioneer wife, Fanny. And it's going to be a wonderful book. Viking Penguin is going to publish it, but she couldn't write it anymore. She cared for me for a year and a half. So we had no income, and it was Joe Talbot's idea, because he's younger, my son who's a filmmaker, saying he not yet made his movie. He was about to start, and he had his own sort of pressures to deal with. But he said, hey, we should do a GoFundMe, which is how he actually started raising money for his movie on a Kickstarter campaign. And lo and behold, you know, we raised over $40,000 within a few days. People, you know, Joe and my sister Margaret Talbot, who's a writer at The New Yorker, just put it out there that my family needed help. And so people did come through. God bless them. And, you know, it's unfortunate. We live in a society, as Bernie Sanders said, when, you know, hundreds of thousands of Americans have to appeal to people's generosity that way to pay for basic health care. That's not right. So I learned the hard way that our medical system is not perfect, far from it. And I also learned about people's generosity and how many angels there are out there. Somebody wrote a lovely note with flowers for my wife, never met her, but knew that she was going through great pressures of her own, caring for me as well as her dying mother at the same time, and knew what Camille must be enduring. It was the most beautiful letter. It was anonymous. We never found out who that person was. And that's the kind of things that we experienced when I was getting through this all. So I believe actually in the angelic power of complete strangers even. And that's what gives me, I think, hope about America's future too.
Mm. Well, Kathy writes, David, thank you for your story. My family is going through a very difficult time as my husband is battling severe medical issues. Is there something that your wife or sons provided that was helpful during your difficult time? Maybe David, Kathy is looking for something, I don't know, specific that she could do for her husband.
Well, you know what was very good to me, for me, I needed stories that would take me away out of my wounded body. I was not able to go outside for a long time. I was not able to walk. So reading to me was so important to hear my brother, Steve, who was a child actor, Steve Talbot, now a producer at Public TV, and his wife, who reads in a plummy kind of English accent because of her background, and my wife, Camille, would all read to me in the hospital, Wind in the Willows. It was such a kind of different, experience. These little funny creatures living in these meadows and the riverbanks of England. It took me out of my pained existence to hear these wonderful, quirky stories from that book. And I tended to be like Mr. Toad anyway in my previous life. I tended to be very impetuous and have grand schemes. And some of my better schemes actually came out of my toad-like enthusiasm. But my wife was always calling me Mr. Toad and saying I needed to slow down, as did the hospital staff. I was trying to get better quicker than I could. But it's very lonely in a hospital. It's lonely recovering. It's lonely at home sometimes. When I came home from the hospital after 5 weeks, I write, my home felt like an Airbnb to me. It felt foreign. It felt like it wasn't my place anymore. So to have people around you remind you of who you are, remind you that you've made improvement, that's very important. You know, they would make a chart for me about how many steps I could walk each day. And you have to believe that you are improving as you go through a long rehab. So the circle of love, as I say, reminding you that you're getting better, reminding you of faraway places and you don't have to just live in the here and now. You can live in your imagination. Both of those were amazingly constructive for me.
Well, let's go next to caller Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary. Join us.
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yes. So I can't wait to read your book, and I love hearing the things you're saying this morning. I've read your columns and your writing in the past, and I've been drawn to it, but sometimes I've put it aside because there would be this bitterness and anger or kind of, you know, they're all messed up out there and we're all so smart and we know better kind of quality that I didn't like at all. And that seems completely gone. You know, what you're espousing now and what you're talking about now, it seems like that other spirit is cleansed. Do you have a sense of that?
Boy, that's a great question. That goes to the heart of who I am, I think. You know, fortunately or unfortunately, I think a lot of my achievement in life as a journalist has been, and I tell you too, as an entrepreneur starting a salon, has been motivated or fueled by anger. I can't deny that. And I think you're right in seeing an anger and a bitterness even in a lot of my writing. I think our country was stolen during my lifetime for many of us, millions of us. I was 12 years old when President Kennedy was assassinated. I was working on his brother Bobby's campaign for president in 1968 in Los Angeles when he too was assassinated. Martin Luther King had been killed just a couple months before. I felt my country was robbed from me as a teenager, and I don't think we've ever recovered. I think there's an arc between John Kennedy's New Frontier and the Dark Ages of Donald Trump, and it's been a downward arc. So how can you not feel anger and even bitterness about that? But I've found after my stroke that was no longer useful to me, that I couldn't be fueled by anger, just anger anymore. And so I wrote this new book more out of love and gratitude and an appreciation for life itself. And so I think at some point, if you do want to carry on, you have to find that joy within you and that fortitude. You know, Bobby Kennedy, who's always been a hero of mine, he was interviewed on KQED, actually, during his last campaign here in California. And he looked like hell. I saw the video of it at a museum, a TV museum in L.A., while I was doing research for my book, Brothers. He looked terrible. He'd been campaigning. He was exhausted. He was sunburned. He looked weary. His eyes, he looked older, 10 years or more older than he really was. And the interviewer asked him, are you still an optimist? After all that you and your family have suffered, are you still an optimist? And Bobby had these sad eyes, these weary eyes. And he said, yes, he was an optimist. He nodded yes. And he said, and then he answered why. He said, just because there is no other way, is there? And that's kind of what I mean about stoic exuberance. You have to choose to live your life at some point, not in despair, but with hope. And that's what I've, with whatever years I have left, I've decided to live my life with hope.
Well, Mary, thank you for the question. And, you know, I can't help but ask you, David Talbot, if you have advice. I mean, I guess in some ways your answer is getting to this, but, you know, we just had this event where we were talking about the chaos in our lives and the sense of just feeling so out of control with our political situation, with climate change. And so for dealing with that anxiety and stress as someone who did feel it so acutely, you know, as you say, you know, with anger and frustration.
How we should survive the current
how
situation.
We deal with it now. Yeah. What perspective to put on it?
Well, I would advise people to read Thomas Merton. He's someone else who I think has been very helpful to me. The great Catholic philosopher who died also, I believe, in 1968, that terrible year. But Merton was a Trappist monk living in a remote existence in Kentucky, I believe. And yet he felt more and more compelled to leave his sanctuary to comment on the Cold War, because he felt America and the world was living under a nuclear shadow and that life itself could end at any moment. And so his writing is very beautiful because he tries to actually combine both things, the reflective inner, his inner soul, as well as a life of activism. And he says you can't lead life without, you have to find a balance between those two. Both are essential. He says America is too caught up in action, in doing things. But if you do that to the exclusion of introspection, then your action is untethered. It's compulsive. It's not thoughtful enough. And we see this all the time in political life. People just crowing about America being great, about how we can do anything. It's not true. America can hardly hold an election anymore, we found out the other night in Iowa. America is struggling and in pain. And so I think it's important for all of us to get in touch with our own pain, too, before we tell others how to act. We have to learn to do what Thomas Merton did, be both introspective and active.
There are a couple of comments here from listeners who are reacting to what you were talking about in terms of how the doctor treated you. And again, if you'd like to speak with David Talbot, the number 866-733-6786, Twitter, Facebook, and our email address forum@kqed.org are also other ways to get in touch with us. So Scott writes, I resonated when David said there's some anger involved in recovery. Did that have to do with the doctor that was kind of gruff with him? I've been through cardiac arrest and had my own experience with that. And then this other listener writes, I think some doctors are so harsh because they have to deal with death and illness all the time. Not a great excuse, but as a daughter of a doctor, I know what I'm talking about. Any reactions to Scott or this listener?
That's a good point. I think doctors, many doctors, have to see such sadness and such tragedy in their daily lives that they become hardened. And that's why I bring up my mother, who worked in this kidney dialysis unit with dying children. She came home every day with high spirits, with even more love for her own children, because she saw what other kids were going through. It never made her bitter or angry. It made her, I think, more committed to life. So I wish more medical people had that attitude. There are a number who do. My other brain surgeon, Dr. Michael Key, I devote a whole chapter to, called A Patient, a Person, Not a Patient, because that's the way he treated me in my during my recovery. It was always almost philosophical and very enlightening for me to go spend time with Dr. Key. Michael Key, his name is K-E, and he's here in San Francisco. A great brain surgeon and a great healer and a great philosopher, I think, about medicine and recovery. So there are those who are out there. My sister, Cindy, is a great doctor. She's in Portland, Oregon. She diagnosed me when the original team at St. Luke's, which is now called something else, couldn't figure out what was my problem. They were going to send me home with a case of the flu. My sister up in Portland over the phone said he's having a stroke. Get him to a stroke ward. Thank God my family did. Cindy has amazing heart. She's like my mother that way. She treats all sorts of patients, many of whom obviously have fatal disease. And yet, and she's able to give me great comfort and advice and came down from her own duties and spent the night, a night or two, in my hospital room with me and consulting with my doctors and so on. And at the time, she was suffering from AFib and had to have surgery later, heart surgery. So she had her own issues. So in a way, I don't buy it that doctors have to become hardened and brusque and cruel. You don't have to. You have to check yourself, like I did as a journalist, as this woman called in earlier was checking me. At some point, you have to say, I don't want to be that person.
And again, David Talbot's book is Between Heaven and Hell, The Story of My Stroke. We're talking with him and we're talking with you. And I'm going to go to listener Rod and in Redwood Shores. Hi, Rod.
Hi, how's it going?
Well,
I just wanted to phone and say that I have had such a similar kind of a thing that I just wanted to share with you a little bit and see if you have anything to say. But first of all, I should let you know that I'm Canadian. I'm down here in Redwood Shores visiting my daughter who works in San Francisco. But in 2016, I had a seizure, a major seizure from a thing called an arterial venous fistula, which grows in your brain. The arteries get smaller and smaller and until they can't handle the blood pressure. So then they bleed into your brain. I was flown to Vancouver for emergency surgery and had excellent care there. I was in the hospital all in all for 3 months and came home and went back to, against their advice, went back to work immediately because I was self-employed, and got my driver's license back, and then took it all on and started having my seizures. And since then, I've been having about one seizure per month. And I'm now in Toronto and getting getting very good care there. But my memory is bad. My balance is bad. My everything about me is bad. And I wanted to thank David for his perspective on life, about feeling good about his situation, even though it's just a tremendous change in life.
And, well, Rod, I really appreciate you sharing your story. David Talbot, I don't know if you have a response for Rod.
Well, just to call in, thank you, Rod. That takes courage for you to articulate your own challenges and what you're going through. And you're certainly facing more than I have to with a seizure each month. I can only imagine how terrifying and tiring that must be for you. So you have my respect and sympathy. But as I say, I've now been put more in touch with this other world, the world of the, as one person said, you know, all of us are only temporarily abled. At some point, we all become disabled. And so I'm much more aware of that other existence and the enormous courage that people have, many, many of them who are coming to hear me speak, like Rod, who are going through their own suffering. And so it makes me more, I think, in love with humanity and what we're all capable of, the incredible courage we're all capable of.
Yes. Tom writes, I was diagnosed with metastatic thyroid cancer last year at 28. Although our ailments are vastly different, I identify a lot with your perspective. I need supplemental oxygen now, and simply put, my life will physically never be the same. I am more passionate, patient, and live with an increased sense of immediateness. The prognosis isn't great. Living with such uncertainty is a heavy weight, but I've found acceptance and appreciate every day. And then Connie asks, do you think you'll ever write for the Chronicle again? Love your writing there and miss your voice.
You know, I love newspapers. I'm glad the Chronicle's still going. I'm glad that, you know, we still have daily journalism because we don't know our city unless we read it. I feel still a daily newspaper reminds us of who we are, what our problems are, what we need to work on. So I loved writing for the Chronicle as a columnist for, I think it was only 6 months. I was brought in as a guest columnist. Mike Gray, who's managing editor, was an old colleague of mine and I think arranged the invitation to me. It made me, like when I wrote Season of the Witch, feel more a part of the fabric of my city. I love San Francisco. I realized, you know, when I came out of the hospital and I was asked to speak before I was really quite ready to speak, I was having difficulty speaking at that point and standing even. And Jane Kim, who was running for mayor at the time, asked me if I would speak at her kickoff rally. And I did. It was a crazy, chaotic room south of Market, big nightclub, a lot of young people hitting the bar in great spirits. And here's this old guy getting up on stage to like attempt to like inspire them, you know. But God bless them. They all listened to me. And they got quieter as I struggled with my speech and tried to fire them up about the campaign, about fighting for the city we love. I felt that way as a columnist, the Chronicle. I was fighting for the city I love. I still feel that battle. has to be fought every day. I love that we have a progressive board of supervisors. Hillary Ronan is my own supervisor. I think she's a great hero. Dean Preston, who we just elected, Matt Haney. And, you know, Chesa Boudin, I worked on his campaign. So did my son, Joe Talbot, and Jimmy Fails, the star of The Last Black Man in San Francisco. And I thought that was a real kind of testament that the city's progressive heart has not been snuffed out, despite all the tech money, despite all the, you know, dark money going into campaigns, and how the city just feels so dystopian now with the suffering and homelessness on the streets and the incredible wealth at the top. It feels in many ways that our city is no longer the city I celebrated in Season of the Witch that's been taken from us. But yet, you know, there's still this fighting progressive spirit. So, yeah, I'm going to die in the city. I love the city. And, you know, I believe in journalism. I believe we need daily newspapers to keep reminding us of what we need to do as citizens of our city.
Well, that's incredibly heartening to hear, David Talbot. And we're actually going to go out with another song from your Songs for Strokies playlist. This is Aretha Franklin's I Never Loved a Man the Way I Loved You. And we just have a 30 seconds or so, if you want to tell us what this song, why you included this song in your list.
Because you can still be sensual after you have a stroke. Get in touch with your body, with your rhythms, with lust, you know, with life. And Aretha reminds me of all those things. God bless Aretha.
That's great. The book is Between Heaven and Hell, The Story of My Stroke. David Talbot, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much, Mina.
And thank you to our listeners for their questions, comments, and stories. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. You've been listening to Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.